Math. Coming up on 10 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Yesterday, we previewed Sunday afternoon's concert of the Racine Symphony Orchestra and their performance of Fauré's Requiem. On today's program, we are previewing yet another concert that is occurring this coming weekend, Saturday evening, 7:30 p.m. at Siebert Chapel on the campus of Carthage College, a concert that features the combined forces of the Carthage Choir and the Carthage Philharmonic in a performance of one of the loveliest works of Felix Mendelssohn, his setting of Psalm 42. And it is a concert that is also going to include a brief example of the music of his very talented sister, Fanny Mendelssohn. And with me in the studios of WGTD to talk about all of this and more are two of my faculty colleagues from the music faculty at Carthage, Dr. Edward Kawakami, Associate Professor of Music and Director of Orchestral Activities, and Dr. Dmitry Shapovalov, Associate Professor of Music, and the two of them also happen to be co-chairs of the music department at this point in time. And we have lots to talk about. Gentlemen, thank you for making time in your busy schedules to be part of the morning show today.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much for having us.
Glad we can have this conversation. I think it would be interesting to talk for just at least a couple of minutes about this intriguing notion that one of you had about the two of you being co-chairs of the music department. It's something not utterly unprecedented, but certainly uncommon. And I don't remember whose idea it was, but in the wake of the departure of Dr. Eduardo Garcia Novelli, who left Carthage, of course, last spring, a new chair had to be found. Tell us how this idea came about of the two of you serving together as co-chairs.
I'm not sure whose idea it was.
Yeah, me neither, but I'm sure that, as I remember, this was a concept that I think emerged out of a discussion that the two of us had with Dean Corinne Ness preceding this present academic year, and we were extremely enthusiastic about working together because we knew even at that time that we worked very well together because we had some opportunities for us to test the ground, so to speak, and discovered, not really to our surprise, but rather to our satisfaction, that we could be productive and make decisions even despite whatever disagreements and vision we may have, and those are always welcome as part of the process.
Yeah, when the proposal was made, it was a no-brainer, so to speak. Normally, of course, departments are headed by one chairperson, but having the co-chair just made absolute sense, dividing the workload. There's a lot of work to do. We're one of the largest departments on the campus with a lot of adjuncts, a lot of moving parts, performances, so on and so forth. So it makes a lot of sense for there to be multiple persons in that role to help facilitate those things.
I am, for one, very glad that I'm sharing this responsibility with you, Ed. I cannot imagine how what we do together would have been the responsibility of a single person. That thought seems inconceivable to me, so I sure am glad to have you by my side.
Ditto.
I suppose it's important for people to understand that to be the chair of the music department means something different from being the chair of a lot of other departments. Not that they don't have plenty going on, but there's sort of a special and messy complexity to any music department, not just the music department at Carthage. And just give our listeners a sense of some of the things that are your responsibility as co-chairs that you're having to shepherd.
Go ahead, Dmitry.
Well, there is much to do. There are many aspects of the chair's activity that just thought to Ed and me to be natural to be divvied up amongst the two of us. There is the matter of the budget. There's the matter of scheduling. There's the matter of kind of day-to-day communications with our fellow faculty and students, and the sort of mundane problems, room assignment, and so on that come up from time to time. What was a discovery for me is just how much caretaking the position of the chair involves. And this is certainly not that I am poor at caretaking, but I think, Ed, this part of the responsibility is certainly your forte, so you could maybe speak to that.
One of the things that's absolutely lovely is Dimitri thinks I do more work than he does, and I think that he does more work than I do, which it means that we're both probably doing about 50%.
I hope.
I hope so, too. But, you know, with our students at Carthage, one of the things that we always hold true to is that our students are at the center of our focus. As you well know, Greg, is we take care of the student. We teach the student, not music, per se. And to do that requires that we do mentoring and advising and things of that sort that normally you wouldn't think of. Music is a different discipline. There's a history of mentorship going back from middle school through high school, and that continues through college.
I think it would be good to hear from each of you about what the last couple of years have been like for you, personally and professionally. And of course, I'm talking about the COVID-19 pandemic and the many ways in which it has complicated the lives of musicians, music makers, not only here, but all around the world. I mean, kind of a cataclysm in terms of the performing arts. Give our listeners some sense of what it has been like for you and the students with which you've worked to weather this really difficult period, and what things are feeling like right now as we make our way hesitantly towards something that feels a little more normal.
I think you hit the nail on the head, Greg, when you say that it's moving hesitantly toward normalcy. We're still not sure about what is normal and what is safe, and we believe that our responsibilities is to balance the educational needs of the student with the safety of the student as well as faculty and members, and to find that happy medium, because playing with masks, singing with masks, and having to have distancing doesn't work. We can't do distanced education like we can with some other classroom subjects. We can teach, for example, a music history course online. That lends itself fairly well. Music education courses I could teach online. There's a number of other things that don't translate well, but we can still do. But we can't do choirs and we can't do orchestras via Zoom. There's just way too much lag. We can't do it. One of the mitigation procedures was to have space in between our musicians when they played or when they sang while masked, which means that half the face, the half of the nonverbals that come from the face are gone, that are missing. And then there's also the delay between 6 feet. What is it? A millisecond every 3 feet something like that delay. So with an orchestra, you've got 50 feet between the front and the back, and all of a sudden it just becomes this unwieldy semi-truck that's driving through high winds.
One of the facts that I am very proud of as far as how Carthage in general and specifically in the music department handled or got through the pandemic is the fact that music never ceased to sound on our campus. This, in light of what Ed just said, this was a considerable challenge, and I'm not just talking about logistics. I'm not just talking about having sometimes the technology to navigate the lag if we were to rehearse online or on Zoom or using some other means. I'm not only talking about matters of rehearsal rooms, which had to be multiplied by a factor of I don't know what. I'm talking about the feeling that music must go on at all times, that whatever it is that we do, whatever music that we are capable of making during this time, with whatever means, must happen as a matter of first priority. So I never felt that the spirit of music making, our commitment to music making, diminished in any sense. In some respects, we actually got even more stronger at the music department, both students and faculty, as we committed to this priority number one, to keep the music going.
And I have to say that we're tremendously proud of what our students did. They always stayed focused. They understood that it was a balancing act between safety and making sure that music kept going. And as a matter of what Dimitri said, I think they came to cherish their music-making experience even more because they had it restricted, because they didn't have free, unfettered access to it like they did before the pandemic.
I think personally, and I don't know if this is true for anybody else, but as a director, I learned a tremendous amount about my art, about the art of choral directing, about music history, the intricacies of sound, and how exactly those vowels and consonants live together in a single syllable, just by having to mix those tracks, to resort to technology as we put our Christmas festival digitally, as we had to record much, as we had to use remote means of instruction. So that was one unexpected consequence of the pandemic, is my own, at least, increased knowledge of the intricacies of what it is that we do every day.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with two of my faculty colleagues at Carthage College, Dr. Dimitri Shapovalov and Dr. Ed Kawakami, who are both associate professors of music and collaborating on a very special concert that's going to be performed tomorrow night, 7:30 p.m. at Carthage's Siebert Chapel, a concert in which the Carthage Philharmonic and Carthage Choir will collaborate in a performance of Felix Mendelssohn's Psalm 42, from which we'll hear a couple of excerpts shortly. And we're also going to be hearing from Felix Mendelssohn's talented sister, Fanny Mendelssohn, a beautiful concert overture that's also on the program. Before we get to all that, I think it's important for us to talk about what an interesting time this is for the Carthage Choir, with the aforementioned departure last spring of Dr. Eduardo Garcia Novelli, who'd been at Carthage for 13 years, but left Carthage to take an unexpected and wonderful opportunity at the University of Kansas, the new basketball champs. And so in the wake of that departure then, explain what needed to be done in terms of keeping the boat flowing through the waters at a time that was already, as we've already said, pretty challenging.
Well, as mad as we all are at Eduardo for leaving us, we obviously love him a great deal and miss him terribly. And what we realized right away is that several of his responsibilities needed to be filled. We already talked about the position of the music chair, but Eduardo was not just the director of the Carthage Choir, he was also the director of choral activities at Carthage. So as we set out to find his replacement, we were mindful of the fact that this legacy of the choir extends beyond that very ensemble and encompasses a whole range of visions and dimensions that must be taken into account. Ed, do you want to talk about the search since you chaired? You were on the committee as a co-chair, and perhaps announced, this would be a good way to announce the final candidate.
Sure, absolutely. Well, beyond final candidate,
our choice. Yes,
yeah.
Sorry.
Whom we're extremely excited about. So the way academic searches work is we get a huge, huge influx of CVs and cover letters and videos, all incredibly talented. And it's a wonderful problem to be in, to have 80 or so CVs that are 10 to 12 pages long and have to sift through those. And then you come up with a candidate pool of 15 to 20, which you then have a Zoom interview with to see what their personalities are like, to see if their vision would match what we have at Carthage. And then we narrowed it down to three persons to whom we invited on campus. They taught some classes. They conducted the orchestra, went through, I think, 3,400 interviews with various faculty
something
members.
Like that.
Yeah, something like that, with administrators as well. And then we came up with our final choice. And, of course, the students were consulted as well because at the end of the day, they're going to be working with the students. So even if we as faculty members look at their CV and look at their body of work and think, oh, this is a fantastic person, if for some reason they're not clicking with our students, that's definitely not a good sign. And we were fortunate to really have some really strong finalists on campus, and it was a difficult final decision. But at the end of the day, we came up with someone that we all could agree on was fantastic, someone that we felt met the legacy of what Carthage Choir was, but also had a vision for what it will be and what our program will be, and bringing fantastic new things. And that person is...
Dr. Maggie Burke.
Yes, and we're so incredibly excited to have her here.
I remember the moment when Dean Ness and President Swallow actually made it to the choir room during one of our rehearsals and announced that Dr. Burke has agreed to join our musical team here at Carthage. And the shout of hooray and joy was, I'm sure, loud enough that it carried through the walls. Mm-hmm. I do believe Corinne actually captured that moment and sent it to Maggie, who, of course, was very touched.
Right. Well, and it was interesting that announcement to the choir came roughly 15 minutes after they had heard from Maggie Burke that she was accepting this position. And so the Carthage Choir was the first to find out. I mean, before any other HR people or whoever. I mean, they were the first to find out this really exciting
news. They appreciated that news.
Aside from the search, we should probably make brief mention of what happened through the fall semester, of course, and, of course, what's happening in this spring semester as well in terms of the choir.
Yeah, so I will even go as far back as last spring when Eduardo had announced that he was leaving for Kansas. And I do remember consulting with Ed and also Dr. Jim Ripley, our other colleague from the instrumental area, and we made this commitment to Carthage Choir that we will preserve the ensemble and its mission as best we can by hiring through this interim year conductor or conductors who would be best suited for this task. And instantly, almost, one name came up, and in the fall we had the privilege of having Professor Rick Biela serve as the interim director of the Carthage Choir. He did just a spectacular job. I learned so much from his creative approach to programming, his in innovative rehearsal techniques, and I think the students also appreciated having someone whose style of preparing the piece was so different from Eduardo's, and yet the result was quite comparable, excellent music making that the choir was able to deliver on several occasions, not the least of which the Christmas festival.
And, of course, in this semester, you are presiding as conductor of the Carthage Choir.
Yes.
In preparation for a very exciting event, which also has undergone a bit of transformation thanks to events
right.
in the world.
Yeah, it is my honor to lead the Carthage Choir this this semester. And this concert, which is going to be tomorrow, like Greg said, at 7:30 p.m., in Siebert Chapel, was actually conceived in 2020, before the pandemic. Eduardo wanted to perform Psalm 42 by Mendelssohn then, and of course those plans were disrupted. So in a sense, this concert will provide a nice closure to his vision and bring to completion an important project that I'm all too happy to carry to its end in performance.
So we are going to talk now about the concert, which is tomorrow evening at 7:30 p.m. in Siebert Chapel, a concert that features wall-to-wall Mendelssohn, but music of two different Mendelssohns, brother and sister, Felix Mendelssohn and Fanny Mendelssohn. So, Dr. Shapovalov, you are a Carthage's resident musicologist, so maybe you should set the stage with whatever you think is important for our listeners to understand about these two talented composers.
Well, the Mendelssohn household was, of course, in terms of just sheer talent, both coming from Fanny and her brother Felix, was one of the most astonishing displays of potential and realized potential, both from the composer's standpoint and just the ability to carry through the name of a household that had already been quite well-known and famous throughout Europe. This is a rich pedigree of thinkers, artists, and visionaries that lived through quite difficult times. I think it's appropriate to talk about Fanny and Felix's grandfather, Moses Mendelssohn, who was a well-respected philosopher, advocating for a range of topics, including the very thorny and difficult problem of assimilation of Jewish ancestry in Western Europe. So this is a family that had Jewish roots culturally and perhaps in some aspects religiously. And the question for that household as they sought to realize their dreams was how to assimilate into the cultural and religious heritage, dominant heritage of the Germanic lands, Prussia, Bavaria, and Austro-Hungarian Empire, where their music was likely to be heard. So this was a difficult question that they decided that they solved in favor of assimilation. So I am connecting this topic to Mendelssohn here, obviously because Psalm 42 is a religious work. It represents the dominant faith of the Western European continent at the time. So in my mind, whenever we talk about Psalm 42 and other settings, Felix Mendelssohn set as many as 19 Psalm settings to music, it is important that this question of faith always arises as quite appropriate to discuss.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this particular work then, Psalm 42, which is kind of the centerpiece of the concert. And one of the things that probably is important for us to acknowledge is both how beautifully he writes for the human voice and also how beautifully he writes for the orchestra. So, Dr. Kawakami, why don't you say a word first about the latter, about just in general the way in which Mendelssohn seems to so beautifully understand orchestral colors and combines them in all of his instrumental works, including this one.
Of course, yes. This is a work, obviously, where the choir and the text come to the forefront and the orchestra plays a supporting role. But you can see his mastery of color and motivic development, his musical sensibilities come through in many of his other works. Of course, we all know Midsummer's Night Dream and the incidental music that accompanies the Shakespeare play, and you could see his use of color and his representation of characters through different instruments and different ideas, musical ideas that he puts forth. And Psalm 42 is absolutely no different. There are fantastic motives that run throughout the seven different selections, and then of course there are some wonderful arias that he's written where the human voice and the instrumental voice meld gorgeously together, each supporting each other and each putting forth the ideas and supporting the ideas of the text.
Dr. Shapovalov, how would you characterize the way Mendelssohn writes for the voice?
Well, I think that first, and not that my opinion is important here, but I think it's also crucial to notice that for Mendelssohn himself, this was
of all the settings of the liturgical texts that he did, in his own opinion, his best work. He named it as his best in one of his letters, and this was confirmed by probably one of the more preeminent music critics and composers of his day, Robert Schumann, who described it as a work of astonishing breadth and vision, and certainly one of Mendelssohn's best. And I think his writing for the voice has a lot to do with this. Mendelssohn was a longtime admirer of Johann Sebastian Bach, whose music he idolized from his adolescence. And famously, at the tender age of 20, the young Mendelssohn staged a comeback for Bach's St. Matthew Passion, thereby almost single-handedly igniting this renewed enthusiasm in the techniques of the Baroque era. And he made, of course, sure that in this psalm, too, he combines those techniques as, for example, the last movement is a very elaborate, intricate, polyphonic setting of the last verse of the psalm using the Baroque form of the fugue. So, but he also has moments of profound clarity where all the voices sing together with the same rhythm. There are soprano arias in cantata that work extremely well with the orchestra. In one of the arias, the soprano interacts with a treble voiced choir. So, and at other points, we have a quartet, a four-part tenors and bass voiced quartet that interacts with the soprano soloist in one of the arias. And by the way, I am forever thankful to you, Greg, for preparing that movement. This will be done almost exclusively with the forces from your ensemble, the Lincoln Chamber Singers. So thank you so much. I just heard this in rehearsal yesterday, and they sounded spectacular.
Glad to hear you're pleased. And yeah, it's a wonderful work, absolutely, start to finish. We'll hear that triumphant final passage at the end of the program, but I think we'll listen to the very start of the work, which is a setting of the verse with which this psalm begins, as the deer pants for the water brook, so longeth my soul for thee, O God. Maybe we should mention the fact that this is one of those works that can certainly be heard in German, is often heard in English, and that's a striking thing about Mendelssohn as well, is how lovely so many of these works sound when they are done in English, which of course was his second language.
Yeah, certainly. I'm glad that we are performing this in English, if only because I think that will be most intelligible for the kind of audience that we will have in Siebert Chapel specifically. Sometimes it's tricky to combine a choir and orchestra in that space. So the fact that this is one of the most well-recognized settings there, you know, I've come across a hymn or two that mimics the same message in actual religious worship. So I'm glad that we're doing this in English.
So here is a little bit of the opening movement of Psalm 42. That was a little bit of the opening movement of Mendelssohn's Psalm 42. One of the things I thought would be interesting to chat about for just a moment is what it's like, Dr. Kawakami, for you to prepare the orchestra and then, in a sense, hand the baton over to Dr. Shapovalov, who's actually going to be conducting the performance itself of Psalm 42. That doesn't happen every day, but it's not a radical idea, of course. But what does that feel like when you're preparing it for somebody to take over, and what's it like for you to then take the podium?
Sure. It actually feels like a lot more responsibility to prepare an ensemble for someone else, because my whatever deficiencies I might have in my preparation are going to impact Dimitri and the Carthage Choir. So I have to make sure that I do my due diligence, that with the ensemble and convey to the orchestra that there is a responsibility of care that they have to be supporters of the choir. Again, the choir and the text and the work are at the pinnacle. That's what we're presenting. The orchestra is supporting that mission, that musical goal. So it actually feels, I worry about it more than the work that I'll be presenting on the concert.
It's funny you say that, because I was going to say exactly the same thing to you, because I feel, first of all, that I'm in a position of privilege to be leading the orchestra and, of course, the choir in this performance. I do feel I'm going to piggyback to what you said earlier, that what we do ultimately centers on our students. So even as we, surround the concert around the Mendelssohn household, it is ultimately about our students. And in that sense, it is my responsibility to carry the vision that you set up when you were rehearsing your wonderful musicians, and to make sure that I do an adequate job. In many ways, I see that as a sort of a similar situation in which I am with respect to Carthage Choir, because for that ensemble too, I am a caretaker, and I feel that I'm responsible for making sure that as Dr. Burke assumes the responsibility, I have preserved the legacy of this wonderful choir.
So what kind of specific challenges does this work present in terms of combining the choir with the orchestra that is accompanying them?
In terms of combining the choir and the orchestra, I think that I don't know, Ed, what your thoughts are, but in many ways, when everything comes together and there's a vision in place, the work, I hesitate to utter these words, but the work kind of sings itself and plays itself. It is so masterfully written by Mendelssohn that the challenge, I think that what is most interesting about the work is to have a consensus on what it is about, surprisingly, because the text of the psalm is complex. In many ways, the movements, if you just look at the text, in the King James Version, as the heart panteth after the water brook, so panteth my soul after thee, O God. And then, my soul thirsteth for God, for the living God. When shall I come and appear before God? And then you see verse after verse these questions that are quite probing. They may seem like the same question. Why art thou cast down, O my soul? Why art thou disquieted in me? Why hast thou forgotten me? Why go I mourning because of the oppression of the enemy? And so on. So the challenge is that the movements seem to be oriented around a similar sentiment, and yet we have a variety of settings, a choral, a fugal, homorhythmic, soprano aria, soprano with other choral possibilities. How do we ask the same question or similar questions from many angles, many philosophical angles, from many timbral standpoints? I think that's the challenge.
Right. And, of course, the other thing is there's all these questions, and some of those questions the psalmist is asking it of himself.
Yes.
And other questions are being asked of God.
Well, and funny you bring this up, because I think that in addition to, or perhaps because this is one of Mendelssohn's best works by his own admission, it also has a profound personal meaning for him. It had when he composed it, and I think it can endure to be so in our minds. With your permission, I am. I know I talked about assimilation earlier. I just want to read a brief passage written by Abraham Mendelssohn, Felix's father, who writes this letter to actually to Fanny on her confirmation. So Abraham made the decision to baptize all four children of his, and Fanny and Mendelssohn as and Felix as well. And he writes this letter to the 15-year-old Fanny. And this is one of the most astonishing letters I have ever read, written to a 15-year-old, that delves into exactly the kind of challenges that we mentioned when we talked about the meaning of Psalm 42 and its text. So it begins, I'll just read a little bit. It begins this way: "You have taken an important step, and in sending you my best wishes for the day and for your future happiness, I have it at heart to speak seriously to you on subjects hitherto not touched upon. Does God exist? What is God? Is he a part of ourselves? And does he continue to live after the other part has ceased to be? And where? And how? All this I do not know, and therefore I have never taught you anything about it. But I know that there exists in me and in you and in all human beings an everlasting inclination towards all that is good, true, and right, and a conscience which warns and guides us when we go astray." I find these words to be spectacularly appropriate to the meaning of Psalm 42, because at the end, after all these probing questions and talking about thirsting for something that is not there, this absence that the soul may feel at times, there emerges at the end of, for the finale, a hope, an affirmation of trust that one puts into something that may not yet reveal itself to us.
Those are powerful, profound words. And, of course, it reminds us also of the intriguing choice that Abraham Mendelssohn made to convert himself and his family from one religion to another for a host of reasons. But clearly, yes, at the heart of some of that was a sincere spirit of searching for what all of this means.
Undoubtedly, my fellow musicologist Clive Brown makes the good point in his book about Mendelssohn that it is impossible to understand Mendelssohn's own moral and religious views except in the context of his family's experience, and the fact that his music champions many texts that converge both for both the Jewish religion and Christianity. I think it's highly symbolic and speaks to a grave difficulty that was facing the Mendelssohn household as they sought the possibility, the opportunity for their voices to be heard. And this was the only way, given the sometimes virulently anti-Semitic context of the 19th century and beforehand, that they could make. This was the only choice that was available to them. So how to reconcile their religious views within themselves is what Mendelssohn's music and Abraham's letter, I think, speak to most eloquently.
We want to make sure to remind everyone that the concert also features music of Felix's talented sister Fanny, a beautiful concert overture that Dr. Kawakami will be conducting with the Carthage Philharmonic, and we're going to listen to a very brief excerpt from the opening of that. What do you want to say about this wonderful piece and what it represents?
Oh, it's It's a fantastic work, but I actually want to hijack this interview for half a second. And I want to interview Greg Berg, who is also part and parcel of this performance tomorrow evening. And you're sitting here talking to us and interviewing us and giving us all this airtime. But,
you're taking over as co-chair.
Apparently.
We all know you, or at least this audience knows you, as a very talented interviewer and radio personality. They probably also know of your recitals at the beginning of the semester, which are widely hailed and enjoyed and well attended. But they also need to know of your work as a vocal instructor and a professor and leader of the Lincoln Chamber Singers. The Lincoln Chamber Singers will also be performing. I feel like the host now. Do I get a salary, Greg? Is that how this works?
I don't see that happening. No.
But the Lincoln Chamber Singers will be performing a selection of Mendelssohn works. What will they be performing?
All right. Let's try to get this back on track. So the Lincoln Chamber Singers will be singing Mendelssohn's setting of Psalm 95, which is O Come, Let Us Worship, which begins with a wonderful extended tenor solo that I am splitting between my four marvelous tenors in the group. And then the sopranos and altos of the group will be singing I Waited for the Lord, which is probably the Mendelssohn work that was done, at least in England, more than any other in the late 19th century. It was just done everywhere and in a myriad of different arrangements. And both of them are just a marvelous example of how beautifully he writes for the human voice. It's as though he just understands how to make a human voice sound especially beautiful. So, and we're doing this overture by Fanny Mendelssohn. Back to business. So
well done, Ed.
Yeah. Thanks.
So real quick, what do you find kind of delightful about this piece?
Well, unfortunately, in the 19th century and even into the 20th century, female composers were not encouraged. The Mendelssohn family did encourage her pursuit of music. She was apparently a virtuoso pianist. She was able to perform all 24 of Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier by the age of 14, which is phenomenal. Mm. One of her teachers gave her a very sexist but well-intentioned compliment by saying that she played as well as a man, which is problematic. And I just want to make clear that that is not my opinion, but just something that was written in the 19th century. Her compositions are just stunning, and unfortunately, there's just one large-scale orchestral work, Overture in C, and it's starting in about the 90s is when there was a resurgence in interest in Fanny Mendelssohn's works, and this is one of them. This is one that's been edited and cleaned up by Joan Folletta, a very well-known conductor. We performed it last fall, and I and the orchestra fell in love with it. Hmm. There's wonderful thematic material. The melodies just sing themselves. It sits well for the string players. She wasn't a string player like her brother was, but she knew how to write for strings. It just sits well. The melodies are just absolutely gorgeous. It is fun. It is well put together. The transitions work really well. Just a wonderful, charming piece that I wish the only problem is it's too short and there's only one of them.
Let's hear the opening measures of it, and this is the recording conducted by Joan Folletta herself.
Thank you.
And this sweet music just makes us wish so much that there was more of Fanny Mendelssohn's music for us to enjoy. But this Overture in C will be part of tomorrow night's concert. So again, it is at 7:30 p.m. in Siebert Chapel. Mendelssohn, both Felix and Fanny, represented on the program with the Carthage Choir, Carthage Philharmonic, and Lincoln Chamber Singers. And Dr. Shapovalov, if people want to attend Saturday night's concert, do they just show up or do they need to make arrangements ahead of time?
Tickets are free, but you do need to reserve tickets. You can do so online. Just look up the events calendar at carthage.edu on the website there, or you can come in person. Just make sure that you allow a little bit of a time in advance to communicate with the wonderful folks at the box office.
Very good. So again, Saturday night, 7:30 p.m. at Siebert Chapel. And Dr. Dmitry Shapovalov, Dr. Ed Kawakami, thank you so much for being part of today's morning show. It was great to speak with you. Best wishes to you and all the musicians who are part of tomorrow night's concert.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
And here is the stirring conclusion to Felix Mendelssohn's Psalm 42. The time is 8:59 here on WGTD. Monday on the morning show, I speak with Justine Cowan about her remarkable book called The Secret Life of Dorothy Soames. Justine Cowan learned only rather recently that her mother had grown up in the famous or infamous Foundling Hospital in London. And she was able to uncover a remarkable amount of information about her mother and her grandmother and the